Hello, this is Pam with broadcast number 3 of the book 90 Years with Dogs by Dorothy M. Norris. When her children had all left home, the author got a Canadian teacher certificate and she returned to British Columbia. There she had an offer for a job on a First Nations reserve on a coastal island. There she adopted a feral puppy, Sam, who was part wolf. The author and the dog had just spotted a very strange creature. Sam decided at that moment to return to his more familiar surroundings, and without hesitation and feeling completely unnerved, I followed. There had been other unusual creatures down there, which normally I would have found fascinating, but fear and the safety I found in Sam's presence made for a hurried departure from this rarely exposed intertidal zone. It was an experience I remember with awe and almost disbelief, but it was never repeated. Sam's greatest find, but certainly not mine, was a wolf skin. Its origin was a mystery, as the local First Nations honor the animal alongside the raven, killer whale or orca, bear, and others in their rich belief system. For many people, the wolf represents loyalty and has the courage and strength of the hunter. Sam's find had lost its dignity. He dragged the skin home for almost a mile. It had not been cleaned or prepared in any way and had possibly been in the sea for some time. It was revolting, but Sam loved it. I tried to dispose of it several times, but on each occasion, he discovered it afresh until one stormy night when the waves were perilously close to the cabin's walkway. It was a relief when I realized it had finally been carried out to sea once more, a more fitting place for the region's mysterious sea wolves. It was not unusual for me to go out of the cabin after dark with Sam. Normally, he came back within minutes, and I enjoyed the creaks and sounds of our surroundings as I waited for his return. One night, after an unusually high tide, I slipped on the wet wood, hitting my head and losing consciousness. The next thing I remember was Sam looming over me and licking my face. Still semi-conscious, I found his collar, pulled myself up into a sitting position, and somehow, with his help, managed to crawl the few centimeters back to the door. I do not recall anything further until the following morning, when I found myself on the floor beside him as I tried to remember what had happened. It was the only night my floathouse door remained unlocked. Usually a heavy bolt and a padlock and chain, together with Sam's presence, made me feel utterly secure. The episode left me with a horrendous black eye, which went through numerous color changes before it disappeared. The bruising attracted both concern and later considerable merriment from community members who knew me, and also from teaching colleagues I met until I had been checked as able to teach by our resident doctor. Fortunately, I was none the worse for my adventure, but it gave me a lasting wariness of wooden walkways and an even deeper affection for my dog. Without Sam's attempts at reviving me and his assistance in my regaining the shelter of our home, anything might have happened. In this isolated lifestyle I had opted for, far away from family who I knew had their own concerns about my well-being, I had become largely reliant upon my massive wolf-like companion. Living so close, indeed, almost on the sea, left me with many incredible memories. I had always loved the sea and had a deep respect for her many moods, tranquil, playful, boisterous, or destructive. The remains of trees and driftwood piled below my kitchen window had gradually accumulated and would brush against the cabin at high tide, but never caused me much concern. They seemed more of a protective layer than a danger, particularly when high tides caused waves to slap across the kitchen window. The ever-changing shoreline, sounds, and scents were unforgettable, but one experience was also very frightening and made me aware that my rented cabin home that I had grown to love was not the idyllic place I imagined. One night, a Pacific storm brought waves and huge pieces of driftwood not only perilously close to the cabin, but right up to my walls and windows. I was too afraid to go to bed and sat in the kitchen with Sam. Perhaps we both sensed that this time things were different. The cabin shuddered with the impact of the huge waves, and water began to trickle through the dilapidated kitchen wall. There were also signs of leakage through the floor, although it was being absorbed by the heavy matting on which Sam usually slept. I wondered what would happen if that wall were breached. My walkway was already underwater and impassable, and the ferocious wind, in any case, would have made escape impossible through the one outside door. My mind worked nonstop, one hand on Sam, strengthened by his reassuring presence, planning through that terrifying night, waiting for the worst and determined to survive. I viewed the kitchen table and its sturdy wooden structure as a potential raft. Sam was such a strong swimmer. I decided to tether him with a long rope to one of its solid legs and looped another rope along the edge to hold on to myself if the cabin collapsed and we were swept out to sea. There was just a chance we could save ourselves. It was an hour after hour of fear. Fortunately, the cabin wall and floor, managed and leaking, survived the night. So did we. The next morning, the shore told a different story. Halfway to the forest, at the end of the cove, an entire house had been washed up by the waves. The walls had folded inwards on the wooden platform that had once held floor and deck, and the roof still rested on its entirety on broken remains. The metal stovepipe with its cone-shaped cap, so like that of my cabin, still protruded crookedly from the wooden shakes, which is another name for roof tiles, and I could only marvel at the twin light fitting on the gable and miraculously still in place, the bulbs unbroken. I was able to examine the washed-up house in detail as it blocked our daily walks along the shore, and it was only when Sam found a safe way of crossing the tiled roof and I carefully followed that our longer walks could be resumed. I learned in due course that the building had been carried by the strong currents across the inlet from another island some miles away. Fortunately, the owners were safe. Eventually, those sad remains were burnt one day while I was at school, but I realized how easily such a tragedy could have involved myself and Sam. By now, I was teaching on the island for almost 3 years. I had seen many changes of staff and other personnel and said goodbye to the majority of the friends I had made during that time. The school's administrator had already left with his family and had offered me another teaching position in a less isolated place. But the decision to move was finally made following advice from one of my own family. When Claudia Ruth came to visit with her two young children, her advice was that if I did not leave soon, I would be there forever. Bushed being the appropriate term. Having so enjoyed watching my grandson playing with the rowing boat and exploring the beach, I had mixed feelings about the thought of leaving. It was also true that I was beginning to accept the many traumas that occurred around me as readily as I enjoyed the many happy occasions within community life, and had no real desire to move on. The new proposed teaching position certainly had much to offer. I would be near old friends and within driving distance of a niece and family in their small town, St. Albert in Alberta. I was assured that the area in which I would be living would be suitable for Sam, and so the decision to move was made. Whether it was a wise one, looking back over many years, I still do not know. Chapter 10, Alberta and the Need for a Cat. At the end of the school year in the summer of 1983, I arranged for my possession to be shipped once more by barge to Vancouver. A few days later, Sam and I said goodbye to our seashore home and made the by now familiar 6-hour ferry journey to the northern tip of Vancouver Island. A friend, Wendy, who had already left some months previously, arranged to meet the ferry with a hired van, a U-Haul. The three of us then traveled down island, took another ferry across to Vancouver on the mainland, and went to the warehouse where the barge had offloaded my goods. These had increased considerably in quantity during my island years, and trunks now filled the floor space of the van, causing us concern for Sam's comfort while traveling. We need not have worried. Ever adaptable, he leaped onto the trunks and settled down, apparently content to see the road ahead over our heads. It was a long drive through the Rockies, leaving behind British Columbia, the province of my birth, and then traveling across the adjoining province of Alberta, The first time we made a convenient stop for Sam, we were both very concerned about letting him roam free at such a high altitude, where the scenery was exquisitely beautiful and the air so pure it took my breath away. I felt that our apparently empty surroundings might tempt him to go off exploring after being confined for hours in such a cramped space. As we stayed by the van, he soon realized that no walk was involved and came back at speed, sprang up onto what must have been a very uncomfortable place to lie, and we continued on our way. Eventually, we drew up at a travel lodge where we booked in for the night. Much to my consternation, the man at reception told us curtly we could not take such a large dog to our room, but as I began to argue, a warning kick from Wendy told me to leave the arrangements to her. I realized why soon after we gained access to our room. She quickly assessed the layout of the building when we took Sam back to the van and went to collect him almost immediately. Returning by the back entrance, she had noted, we feared that he would start one of his prolonged and penetrating wolf howls if left alone too long. However, he settled down in a corner while we made a hot drink, ate a snack, and retired to our beds exhausted. I was amazed at Wendy's resilience in driving the U-Haul such long distances with relatively short breaks for food and rest. But my time in Canada had already made me realize that a number of my colleagues had acquired an utterly different set of life skills to my own. Many I would myself experience and adopt in the ensuing years, but at that time I had much to learn. We left at early light, hoping that Sam had not left hair on the poor quality floor covering where he had slept. Usually I groomed him frequently, especially during the warmer months, as his undercoat of cream-colored wool shed everywhere and often included the longer, darker, coarse hairs of his outer coat. Since leaving our island home, where there had been no time for such brushing and combing activities, which I had found essential and which he enjoyed. Arriving at our destination in St. Albert, Alberta, where my niece gave us the key to a house she had found and rented on my behalf, we unloaded my things with the help of my nephew-in-law. Wendy was anxious to start her homeward journey to return the U-Haul on time and go home to her husband, so after some refreshments and a short rest, I sadly watched her depart. Sam and I were left to settle in together. I recall little of that first night, apart from waking suddenly to a thundering noise that shook the house and nearly frightened me out of my wits. It turned out next day that the house and yard, I already thought of it as a promising space for a garden, was right beside a railway line. Such rail tracks became a prominent feature for Sam and myself during the next 6 years as, paradoxically, it was the safest place for Sam to have his daily exercise. Most of the small prairie towns in Alberta grew up around the junction of a north-south-east-west line largely used by freight trains. These could have two engines and pull as many as 100 wagons. They carried bells or whistles, which were sounded at roughly mile intervals when approaching a small settlement where a track crossed the line. The trains traveled slowly, so crossing the lines required being very patient and prepared for a long wait. However, trains were infrequent and could be heard many miles away. Their sound carried on the rails long before being able to detect the bell or whistle. When my father first came to Canada in the early 1900s, he had been a member of a railroad construction gang, and he had worked his way to the position of surveyor with the Canadian National Railway. The personal link that was always present in my mind while Sam bounded ahead, investigating the embankment on either side of the track. The scenery and wildlife varied through each year, and while Sam enjoyed the freedom, I treasured the solitude. We never met another walker, and on the odd occasions our work coincided with the passing of a train, I reveled in the cheery calls from the cab, and even occasionally a cheeky little blast from the whistle. After some months, I was able to buy my own property in a small town of Morinville, appropriately placed for my new school that was situated about 12 miles away across the prairie. As most of the teachers lived in the same area, a minibus took those of who could not drive there each morning. The return was not easy, as we had to wait until the last teacher was free to leave, so the working days became rather stretched. But life was generally not as good as I had expected. we teachers were not made welcome locally due to historic antipathies between the settlement and their Plains Cree neighbors. Some of the latter also resented that they had to employ us to teach in their school. They were still reliant on non-Indigenous teachers while community members gained their own professional qualifications now that responsibility for education had been handed from the government to Indigenous communities. Meanwhile, the senior school managers seemed determined to get value for money from their brought-in teachers. Gone were the days of being welcomed into private homes on the reserve, as I had become accustomed out on the West Coast. Unfortunately, the distrust shown to us was also visible in relationships within their own community. As these memories focused on my years with dogs, I will not say much about my new teaching situation except to say that, as in most situations, there were positive and also difficult aspects, some of which I never fully understood, and others I only came to understand in the ensuing years. As part of the teaching and mentoring program, we each had a classroom assistant, and my first one was a lovely lady of my own age. Her husband worked on a trap line, securing both food and pelts as a living. When I first organized my classroom, she carefully fastened various cultural objects to the classroom entrance, which she explained would ward off evil and keep us safe. These traditional artifacts included a long-stemmed pipe, a bunch of sweet grass, and eagle feathers. I did not understand their significance at the time, but I felt she only had my well-being in mind. We became great friends within the confines of the classroom. As always, I found the children delightful despite the problems, which sadly some of them would always have. Away from school, the teachers, many with their own families, shared interests that invariably included cats, for where there are giant silos on the Canadian prairies, there are also abundant mice. We formed our own little community, something I would find extremely comforting in the difficult years that lay ahead for us all. Soon after arrival, I had to arrange a visit to a vet so that Sam could have the legally required injections while there the subject of cats arose. My first rented home in Alberta was infested by mice, and I found mouse traps everywhere, something I found most distasteful, having kept mice as a child, and later I had them as classroom pets alongside rabbits, hamsters, and budgerears. My new house had no little furry visitors, but I had been assured they would move in when cold weather arrived. Very aware of the environment Sam and I had left behind, and that he could be genetically prone to regard cats as potential food. The vet put my mind at rest. Sam had a very gentle temperament, was happy and well-fed, and the vet thought that the half-grown cat he had in mind to deal with the mouse problem would not only be a companion, but could take care of itself. He was correct in his assumptions. When I first introduced the tabby to Sam, he was sleeping happily on the kitchen floor. Raising his head with interest as I opened the hamper, I was horrified when she launched herself at him, spitting with anger, probably because she had been cooped up so long. He had never seen a cat, and she went straight for his nose, giving him a nasty scratch. He just got up and shook himself, towering over her, surprised at this creature that I had brought home. After such an unpromising start, she probably slunk off to explore the new house, but they would become lifetime friends. This companionship became very important due to the unusual elements of my new teaching post. There seemed to be several conflicting factions on the reserve that affected decision-making and general peace of mind. Somewhere, an idea arose that by requiring us all to attend regular retreats away from school and home, the experience would have a healing effect within the community. With hindsight, the brutal legacies of colonial treatment had such traumatic effects upon successive generations that forms of cultural healing were needed to allow for practical, material, and spiritual recovery to take place. But for most of the teachers who, myself included, entered Indigenous education in the 1980s with little or no historic knowledge of what European settlement had meant for Canada's earlier inhabitants, the compulsory attendance at retreats was just another demand upon our time, energy, and commitment. We were not always willing learners. often with little warning, teachers and classroom assistants would be obliged to travel by coach or air hundreds or even thousands of miles to some destination to take part in communal gatherings. This was very disruptive to teachers' lives, having to leave husbands, wives, children, or in my case, pets, at short notice for a very long weekends away. I was fortunate, as the teenage daughter of a colleague who lived nearby volunteered to look after Sam and the cat I had named Gypsy Bella. Other colleagues faced practical problems that were harder to resolve. The retreats sometimes involved attending sessions that seemed unrelated to either teaching or the reserve's beliefs and cultural practices. However, they did allow time for some very interesting and enjoyable experiences for a few of us, particularly as these trips introduced me to new places in Canada and down in the United States, and also the fascinating cultural diversity of Indigenous groups that sometimes attended from elsewhere. Nonetheless, it was always a great relief to return home and resume our normal day-to-day routines. The fact that Sam had a somewhat unpredictable four-legged companion when I was away was a concern, but when, after some months, I found Gypsy Bella was sleeping curled up beside him, I knew the vet's advice had been good for all of us. Chapter 11, Surviving Winter Ice. The Albertan winters were longer and colder than anything I had previously experienced. I was concerned at how Sam would cope because we had seen much rain but little snow on our previous island home. Rain did not trouble him, as ours had been rainforest country, and for a large part of the year I had worn fisherman's boots to walk to school. But the Alberta climate east of the Rockies was completely different. My first heavy snowfall occurred on the evening drive back from school when we were hit by a complete whiteout and the bus spun out of control off the road. No one was hurt, and I recall that my main thoughts were for Sam. Shock had erased the immediate memories of the event itself. By now, Sam had the full run of a large piece of land surrounded by a high wooden fence behind the house, but no daytime shelter while I was at school. When I got home eventually after the accident, Sam was my first thought, but there was no sign of him. Anxiously, I scanned the garden area, and to my relief, I saw a black patch that proved to be his nose. He had dug a hole in the deep snow cover and made himself a cozy den. And after that, I had no concern for his well-being. Gypsy Bella never went out in the snow and over the years proved to be a real house cat. The railway line where we enjoyed our daily walks was little affected by ice and snow. The engines were equipped with snow plows, and although the freight trains were infrequent, the rail seemed to remain clear. Snow did not build up on the embankment where the line was laid, but lay deep on either side, as Sam soon discovered when we plunged up to his neck in it. He and I were more interested in the tracks left by wildlife. I could tell when he put his nose to the ground that something was there. Bird tracks were common, although I had yet to recognize them. There were small rodent tracks, too, the distinctive line of their trailing tail clear in the snow. Occasionally, they had come to a swift end, a flurry and a red patch showing where a bird had found or been found as a meal. We saw snowy owls very frequently perched in the trees nearest the railway line. The houses thinned out at my end of town, and there was a small dugout lake between my home and the railway track. The earth from the excavation was piled into two long mounds reminiscent to me of England's prehistoric long barrows. They seemed rather barren features, although on a few occasions Sam had the excitement of chasing muskrats nearby. He enjoyed the water, but when it froze over during our first Albertan winter, it nearly cost him his life. I had noticed before the first snowfall that someone had constructed what I thought was a raft, pulled up on the water's edge, and I thought that it belonged to some local children, although I never saw any on our walks. Indeed, on these outings, I seldom met anyone then or in subsequent years. People just did not walk, with or without dogs. When the lake and the much larger lake near the school froze over, I learned that many of the staff were looking forward to skating. I was intrigued to hear people talk about ice augers and the need to test for an acceptable thickness before the children and adults could put their skates on and venture out safely onto the ice. In this new life, I felt ready to try every fresh experience. I had never skated on ice, and I found keeping my balance on any slippery surface difficult. The hazards of the school playground every winter was a tremendous challenge I could not avoid. One day, Sam ran out onto the frozen lake and plunged through a patch of thin ice. I had not yet heard of ice fishing, where a hole is sawn through the ice and the angler sits on a box or stool or some form of platform with a baited line through the hole. I learned later that this activity, simple in itself, can be quite elaborate and even comfortable with a shelter over the hole and hot drinks facilities laid on. But this frozen over ice hole was the work of a real amateur. There was no indication to suggest this thin ice and the raft I had seen previously was some meters away from where Sam was now struggling to get out of the icy water. He was a very strong swimmer, but all he could do was thrash around, desperately trying to get a grip on the surrounding ice. I watched and called encouragingly to him, my own fear mounting as I dare not risk going onto the ice myself. I knew that only a few minutes in such icy water can prove fatal. Then I thought of the raft. "I'll be back," I called, a phrase I have used with all my dogs when leaving them for any reason, a day's work, or in this case, as short a time as humanly possible, as I was desperately scared. I knew the chances were that the wood would be frozen to the ground and I would not be able to move it, but miraculously it came away with a violent tug. Tug. I always carried a length of rope when out walking with Sam. I had found it on the Pacific shore after some past storm. Looped through Sam's collar, it gave him more freedom to explore than a lead. I also had been warned about the risk of meeting skunks or porcupines in Alberta, the former because it is so difficult cleaning an animal that has been sprayed, and the latter because of its deadly quills. Fortunately, we had never met either on our walks, although I had smelled the result of a skunk's visit to someone's garden, and occasionally we saw dead porcupines on the road to school. Now I pulled the rope through a gap in the frame and tugged it back to Sam, pushing it into the ice as close as I could so that I could lie at full length in the hope of reaching him. Somehow, I got the rope through his collar. By this time, he had almost ceased struggling to get up onto the ice, but the pull on his neck and the proximity of the platform and myself was sufficient for him to fight once more and heave himself out as I tugged. I do not recall much of the journey home. The whole event had been very traumatic. I was terrified that Sam could have been in the water too long, and I was shivering uncontrollably with cold despite the feather-filled padded coat I wore. I wrapped him up in a blanket and got into a hot bath of water myself. I was mightily relieved to find he was all right and unscathed next day. I was fine too, just rather shaken by what might have been a very different outcome. The ice hole experience did affect our walks, for I no longer allowed him to run free until we reached the railway line and I began to explore some of the roads and tracks that crossed the line from east to west. The land had been divided on a grid system by the early settlers, and any variation in the scenery was due more to nature than human intervention. As the seasons changed, I gradually changed the time of our walks, too, particularly as my work left me too tired to take Sam out after school. It was very peaceful to be out while the settlement was still asleep. One day, I witnessed something that I might otherwise never have seen, the early morning removal of an entire house on a wide transporter. It had been jacked up and lifted in its entirety from the concrete walled basement to the vehicle prior to its journey to a new site. I would later see buildings on the move complete with police escort, often traveling long distances on the highways, but this North American scene was a new one to me at the time. What Sam made of the flashing lights and general activity I cannot imagine, but unlike most dogs, he never barked and just stood watching silently at my side. I went back several times to see if another home was rising from the roofless basement rooms, but the growth of vegetation was the only change I could detect, gradually obscuring the truncated pipes and electric wiring left in situ. During this Albertan phase of my life in Canada, I saw much of my niece Carol and her growing family who lived to the south of Morinville. I experienced the welcome of Canadian-style family Christmases, glitzy shopping malls, and after an evening visit, long drives home with ice chains on the tires as we traveled on top of deep-packed snow. Both my daughters came to Morinville at different times. Claudia Ruth visited one summer, so we traveled around, and Heather came out one Easter and spent time in my classroom. My older children, Claudia Ruth and Jeremy, had homes and work, and their own children were growing up fast. I recognize that every school year proved harder than the last term, and I realized why so many Canadian teachers seem to prefer rented accommodation to owning their own house. Again, I saw much change over the years, for however idealistic some teachers were when they started teaching, the continuous pressure on our personal leisure time, the changes in extracurricular activities in the evenings, and even at the weekends became too great. Despite the welcome holidays and time spent with my family, both Canadian relatives who had welcomed me so warmly into the extended clan, and my grown-up children and the fast-growing grandchildren back in Europe, my health was slowly deteriorating again. By the end of my fifth winter in Alberta, my thoughts were frequently on retirement. I even began to think seriously about returning to the United Kingdom and what it would involve for Sam and Gypsy Bella. Finding information was harder in pre-internet days, but with help I obtained details for quarantine on entering the UK and the long-term kenneling that would be required, a daunting consideration for both animals, but particularly worrying in relation to Sam. It was hard to imagine such an enormous, loving animal living alone within an enclosure for many months. Then there were transport requirements from Canada Air and costs involved, and of course a move would involve selling my house. By the time I had researched all the necessary details, yet another teaching year had commenced, and again I was fully committed to a new group of students. Chapter 12, Returning to Vancouver Island. Life is full of the unexpected. The first weeks of the next autumn term proved too much, and my doctor said I must stop teaching immediately. I and my colleagues were all covered by private health insurance negotiated when we joined the school, and so there was no financial obstacle to accepting this advice. With much relief, at last I was able to put the responsibilities of a long and varied working life behind and take the enforced period of rest required. That would enable me to regain my health and think about what might come next. Over the years, several friends had accepted new teaching positions on Vancouver Island, British Columbia. It did not seem such an unfamiliar step to take, as I had traveled on the island some years earlier. A cousin who lived there suggested that when my health was restored, I moved there, staying with her until I could obtain another house. I had ample time now to plan, sift through the advice and suggestions that flooded in, and view the future with more optimism, something that had been sadly lacking in recent months. The move, when it came, went smoothly, thanks to all the help that came flooding in. Relocating would inevitably affect my contact with relatives, too, on either side of the Rockies. With my niece and her husband dealing with the sale of the house in Alberta, and a cousin anxious to find another suitable property for me in Vancouver Island, my main concern was the safe transit of Sam and my cat. Having previously found that Sam would need the largest cage supplied by the airlines, this was ordered. It came in three pieces, top, bottom, and door, but was easily put together, a formidable hamper with padlock and key for extra security. Two memories stand out from that eventful flight from Edmonton. One, the awful moment at the airport when I watched my precious dog in his huge cage and Gypsy Bella's small cat hamper disappearing into the distance, knowing that they would be cooped up alone, not understanding what was happening to them for a considerable time. I would not be able to see them when we arrived at Vancouver, and I just had to rely on the airport staff for their safe transfer to the smaller plane to Victoria. The second memory is of our actual arrival. It turned out to be the funniest baggage collection I have ever experienced. My cousin met me as planned. Victoria Airport seemed rather unsophisticated and small, so she was able to park close to the building and meet me in the baggage room. This had one conveyor belt leading from outside through the conventional curtain around the room and out again. The continuous slow motion was ideal for boxes, packages, and cases, and we retrieved mine and waited patiently for Sam and Gypsy Bella to appear. There was quite a delay, and by the time they came into view, we were the only people still there. The cat was mewing piteously, but Sam was standing, looking through the grill of his gray hamper, possibly as excited and relieved as I was to see them. Unfortunately, we could not possibly retrieve him, and in our consternation, we missed grabbing the cat hamper, too. Standing helplessly, we watched both animals exit through the curtain again, appearing and disappearing several times without anyone outside apparently noticing. Frustration mixed with my delight seeing them safe and sound. Concern ebbed away and I could see the funny side. In the end, my cousin went off to find someone who could assist us and finally reappeared with a member of staff with the trolley. The conveyor belt was stopped and at last I could retrieve my pets. The trolley man was so intrigued by the whole situation that he had not only conveyed our possessions to the car, but helped undo the nuts and bolts that held Sam's cage together, the only way the car could accommodate everything. Meanwhile, Sam had been able to stretch his legs around the parking lot and was ready to accompany us on the next stage of our journey. What he thought of the strangest day in his life, who can tell? At that time, my cousin owned a property only a short drive from the small town where I had planned to buy a house. Staying with her was enjoyable, as we were both free to spend a few leisure weeks visiting friends and exploring the forested regions in the lower end of Vancouver Island. One day we drove to a lovely stretch up the southwest coast with Sam, walking along the deserted shore before we found a place for our picnic lunch. Sam raced in and out of the sea, but showed no desire to take a long swim as he had done in the past, frequently returning to our side to share the joys of his life with us. We chose to stop at a waist-high log, part buried in the sand, with a meter-wide surface on which to sit, unpack our picnic, and enjoy the endless view over the Pacific Ocean, a remnant of some forest giant already trimmed to a standard length and ready for the sawmill. It had obviously escaped some vast raft of timber and had been washed ashore in a storm. It seemed a perfect spot to eat, talk, and enjoy the sun. Relaxing after lunch and lazily looking toward the horizon, my cousin suddenly shouted, "Quick! We must get out of here. I'm sure that's a huge wave." All I could see was a long gray line where the sky and sea met, but the urgency in her voice was unmistakable. We swept our things into our bags, called to Sam, who was near the water's edge, and raced for the steep bank leading to higher ground. Most people know about tsunamis now thanks to mass media, but at that time, despite my interest in geological matters, I had given the subject very little thought and did not know about the historic records relating to Vancouver Island and British Columbia's west coast. I heard the panic in my cousin's voice as we scrambled up to higher ground, helping each other and calling Sam, who I knew would be close behind us. In fact, he found an easier path, and we reached the top together from different directions before daring to stop to look back. Already, our great log was tumbling around in a deeply troubled and churning sea. What had seemed to be its final resting place was gone, and it would soon continue its journey to some other unknown shore. We had reached safety only in just in time. My cousin said there must have been some underwater seismic occurrence far out to sea to cause such a freak wave. I think she was more shaken with the experience than me. She realized how close to disaster our picnic outing had been. As in previous situations that had become dangerous, my only thought had been for my dog's safety. During the rest of my stay, we experienced a small earthquake that shook the chairs we were using, but I knew that earth tremors were quite frequent and few people gave them much thought. Over subsequent years, I had to straighten a few pictures that hung at odd angles. My brother showed me the safest place in my house should there be a big quake, but it was easy to put such things to the back of one's mind. I learned to store water in case of sudden broken pipes and keep tinned food supplies in case of mishap had been known since a wartime childhood. Being prepared was better than being over-anxious. My cousin Sam and I had a delightful time while I awaited the move into the house I had chosen on the outskirts of the small town of Duncan, further north. We visited a number of smaller islands by ferry, walking for miles along many winding country lanes, so very reminiscent of the English countryside. I was not surprised that there were so many descendants of British Canadians settled in this part of Canada. There comes a time, however, when the pleasures of recalling shared childhood and teenage memories are exhausted, and it was a relief when the day eventually came for the animals and I to move into our own space. The change probably meant little to Gypsy Bella, as she had remained an indoor cat of her own choice. There were plenty of opportunities to explore, but she preferred to sit and observe what went on around her, and our new home in Duncan had a sun deck which was ideal for her. I had arranged for the garden to be divided into two by a fence. The one adjacent to the house formed a secure enclosure for Sam. It contained a large, gnarled plum tree and an old grapevine, and the sun duck provided shelter. A friend would later design and construct a large kennel, almost a small shed for him under one side of the deck where he could lie. But for many months, he had easy access to a large... A staircase led to the four upstairs rooms, and Sam used to mount them three steps at a time, descending the same way. I think he enjoyed our latest home as much as I did. Daily walks with Sam first consisted of getting to know the small town of Duncan before we ventured further afield. As with my previous experience in Alberta, we did not encounter other dog walkers, but it was an ideal way to make new friends and acquaintances. Unlike many Canadian settlements, it also had a distinctive historical central area of red brick and wooden buildings that was easy to explore on foot. I found, too, that Sam was welcomed in a number of places, including the bank, the flower shop, the second-hand furniture store, where I became a good customer as I gradually added items to our home, and the bookshop. The latter, which we visited frequently, was unforgettable. Floor-to-ceiling bookcases divided a relatively small space into a series of dimly lit corridors, each too narrow for Sam to turn so that he had to back out of some of them. Wherever there was a corner leading to the next row of shelves, it was likely to find the elderly owner perched on a stool. He was always pleased to see us and did not seem to expect to make a sale, although I am sure he was glad when one took place. He just loved books and welcomed any visitor, and his benevolence was extended to Sam, who received an occasional pat on the head when the old man was not holding some ancient volume. We lived very close to the edge of Duncan, and I soon found an area where Sam could enjoy complete freedom. It was a flat area of what must have been farmland, which lay between the Canadian Highway, the road that ran north-south along the length of Vancouver Island, and a less used road leading off to the west. This abandoned patch of land retained a group of very old apple trees where I was able to harvest windfalls every autumn, but there was no sign of the original farmstead. The old wooden buildings, which were either raised up off the ground or had dirt floors, had left no visible trace, although I always hoped to find some clue to who might have once lived there. Sam and I enjoyed the area almost daily, and I even sat and sketched there from time to time, enjoying the sense of solitude. While he explored the scrub around me, no one ever warned me to keep an eye alert for bears during the fruit season, or indeed for cougars. Perhaps they thought, if it even crossed their mind, that I knew about such hazards. I regarded our tranquil setting as a relic fragment of English countryside recognizable from childhood. The roads on Vancouver Island were a different matter. I found it very stressful to walk even a short distance at the side of the highway to reach open land on the far side, and although Sam and I explored the area to the west, it was more out of a wish to find what was there than for the enjoyment of a different walk. We had the old farm site to ourselves for several years, only meeting one person, a woman who lived in her small vehicle and parked there for a few days. I was just beginning to get to know her when one morning I found she had gone and we never saw her again. Then, without warning, a construction team moved in and I sadly watched my apple trees torn up and the walks we had loved turned to ugly scars where the greenery had been stripped away. It was the beginning of a new bypass to connect the highway and our local road and signaled the eventual end of our country walks. Chapter 13, A Change of Pace. We had been living in Duncan for about 2 years when Sam's annual health check revealed that he had a lump, which the vet said needed removing as soon as possible. It was an utter shock, as I was so used to his sturdy presence and companionship that I had seldom thought about his age. My retirement years were proving interesting, enjoyable, and very busy. I was facilitating 2 Spanish classes, teaching English as a foreign language, running several adult education courses at the local college, and doing a range of other voluntary tasks that included working in local politics. I joined 2 clubs for the expatriates and an outdoor activities group who explored the nearby coast and local islands using an old privately owned cruiser. We met at Cowichan Bay and our trips took us considerable distances, sometimes to islands under American control, where our skipper seemed to have little need of paperwork for the time we spent ashore. Away from these sea trips across the international boundary marked more rigidly on paper than on water, I also enjoyed a local walking group. Sam would accompany me on these hikes through the former logged territory or along the cleared strips of land where electricity pylons stretched for miles and through otherwise inaccessible forested areas. In addition, we had our daily walks. I made frequent visits to the local First Nations tourist attraction and cultural heritage center where occasionally I ran into old acquaintances from my early years on the West Coast further north. Sometimes they remembered and inquired after Sam and were astonished that he was still alive and well. On the day of Sam's operation, it seemed the only place where I might find comfort and support. In the center of the large, traditionally designed wooden hall displaying a variety of locally produced carvings, knitted outdoor wear, and the occasional stone sculpture from elsewhere, there was a large chest draped with a magnificent wolfskin. It was not for sale, and I was never quite sure why it was there, but I was drawn to it and often stroked the thick coat as I passed. I now found solace in its presence, recalling the times when Sam was young and my own years spent teaching and living so closely with people who honored their own affinities to Raven, Killer Whale, and the Wolf Clan. Seeking strength, I prayed to their great spirit for a safe outcome to his operation. I was not sure how long I stayed there or how I spent the long afternoon that followed, but how I welcomed the vet's phone call to say Sam was all right. I had to accept, once Sam was safely home again, that he was beginning to show his age. He no longer took the basement steps in two or three great leaps and sometimes chose to remain in the garden or downstairs rather than spending the evenings with Gypsy Bella and me. Otherwise, the daily pattern of our lives continued happily, and the tumor did not reappear. One amusing incident during my time in Duncan was the annual visit of a traveling circus. It was still considered acceptable to many people for performances by dogs, horses, lions, and elephants to take place, and the majority of the circus folk who visited the town ensured the well-being of their animals. From previous visits, I knew that the elephants were outside quite early each morning on a patch of ground where Sam and I often walked following the loss of our farmland to construction. We had met the elephants before, and Sam had accepted their presence. On this occasion, I stopped for a brief chat with their keeper, as there were rumors that it might be the circus's last visit due to protests having been made about their use of animals. He was extremely worried because it was his livelihood at stake and the well-being of all the circus families. My thoughts were on what he was saying and not the close proximity of the nearer elephant to Sam. The former suddenly decided to empty its bladder, and the reason it was out there, and Sam was in full range. I had never appreciated until that moment how much liquid an elephant can eject so suddenly. Despite moving quickly, I got sprayed, and Sam, much to his surprise, received a lot more. The keeper was apologetic but very amused. Poor man, he had little to smile about that season, and it was the last time the circus came to Duncan. Over the next 2 years, Sam and I spent more time in the garden rather than exploring the local countryside. He still enjoyed our walks, but at a slower pace, and as there were bear traps located in several strategic places, including one very close to home, I began to consider our safety for the first time. During the apple season, bears were attracted to the trees on outlying properties, and having heard of someone losing their small dog to some unfortunate encounter, I became alert to their possible danger, which was probably general knowledge to most long-term island residents. Occasionally, bears ventured into town, and one was seen in my own road, probably the reason for the sudden appearance of a bear cage in the parking area of the local library. When trapped, the bears were conveyed to a safe distance from town before being released. Sam was very much beloved by one of my next-door neighbors, an elderly lady who liked to walk with me when I was gardening. When Sam started accompanying me into the cultivated part of our garden, she would go to the low fence where it was easy for the lady to stroke his head and talk to us both. She and her husband both enjoyed this friendship with Sam. My neighbors on the other side were afraid of Sam because of his size. What they thought of his wolf howl, I never knew. He raised his nose to the sky and howled very seldom. But his friends next door loved to hear him and always commented on it when we next met. I wondered whether he was communicating with some distant call from the mountains, which we could not hear. When Sam began to avoid the basement steps instead of plodding up them to sleep in the kitchen at night, I knew the signs and moved his bedding down to the furnace room. He was quite happy to curl up in the warmth, but continued to use his outdoor shelter under the sun deck during the day, even in the winter. He liked the space outside where he could see and hear what was going on. He had to navigate the three steps from the furnace room to the garden level, but seemed to accept the stiffness of his legs and other limitations. One morning, I found that he could not get up. He was too heavy to lift, and I could see from his eyes that he had quietly reached the end of the wonderful life we had so enjoyed together. He was a little over 14 and a half. The vet and his assistant could not have been more kind, leaving me to grieve alone, but telling me to ring the practice if I needed someone. I only fully appreciated the vet's professional friendship and consideration a short time later when Gypsy Bella died suddenly. She was walking across the room one evening to settle in her usual place on the settee when she had what the vet later called a heart attack. I called the emergency line and he arrived in a matter of minutes, but it was too late. Completely baffled, he asked if he could do an autopsy as she showed no sign of anything being wrong. She had searched the entire house after Sam's death, and I am sure she missed him. It turned out that she had a congenital heart condition never picked up by the three vets who had handled her, but it explained a lot. Apart from her initial meeting with Sam in Alberta when she scratched his nose, she was the quietest cat I have ever had, who had never ventured into a garden and preferred bird watching from the sun deck to attempting to stalk and catch one. With the loss of these two companions, who had been such constants of my life in Canada and no family living close, I was now very alone. The veterinary practice remains in my memory as a model of what all such practices should be. At the loss of a pet, everyone at the surgery put their names on a card of condolence, a small, kindly gesture, but how much it helped. What a different attitude this is to a request for immediate payment while the owner of some precious companion is still in a state of grief and shock. Chapter 14. Rescued Just in Time. The chasm left by losing Sam and Gypsy Bella was immense. Sam had been both companion and friend, while Gypsy Bella had offered comfort with her indoor presence. I had no desire to replace either of them and spent ever more time on my hobbies and volunteer work. It seemed to be the most effective way of relieving depression and loneliness. Days and routines organized around animal care since I had first come to Canada required feeling differently. An empty house was hard to come back to. Looking back on that period, I think I was managing reasonably well, but at least one friend had different thoughts on the subject. She lived on her own, a little way out of town, and often dropped by in typical Canadian style for a cup of tea and a cookie when passing by. One day, she arrived full of concern. There had been a dog roundup on the First Nations land in the vicinity of her home. The dogs were being held at local kennels for a very short period prior to being put down unless homes could be found for them. She did not know that I had experienced culling of dogs previously in Alberta and British Columbia and my own views on the problems caused by having unneutered dogs freely breeding in a community already beset by many human tragedies. My friend felt I might be interested in acquiring another dog and saving a canine life. I was not yet mentally or emotionally ready for this step, but her persuasion and the scenes I had previously witnessed prompted me to accompany her to the dog pound. I barely remember those dogs. They were a dispirited and cowed bunch of small, indeterminate mixed breeds, accustomed to surviving outside by their own wiliness and not used to being deprived of freedom. They stood behind a wire fence and were wary of human contact. Only one approached where we stood, a little black and white creature who seemed fearless and friendly. She seemed too young to have experienced human unkindness and living by her wits, and the thought of what lay ahead for her was too sad to contemplate. As my friend had anticipated, I found almost by accident that I had acquired another dog. She came with the name Abu, probably given to her by a group of children who had treated her as an adorable toy until she outgrew that role and they had abandoned her to fend for herself. I was not happy with the name, as I felt it might have some meaning of which I was not aware, but before I had found an alternative, I introduced her to a group of ladies who met once a week at my house to learn Spanish. Abu had quickly made herself at home, sensing the renewed security which she had experienced so briefly in her short life. She was friendly and playful and had a funny habit of suddenly chasing her own tail, which made visitors laugh. It seemed appropriate that Risa, the Spanish word for laugh or laughter, should be added to her name, and so she became Aburisa from then on. Unfortunately, only 2 days later, when the male equivalent of my lady's Spanish class took place, another side to Aburisa's character was revealed. Without warning, she launched herself at the ankles of one of the men who was meeting her for the first time. The attack was so aggressive that only the quick action of another class member prevented him from being bitten. He lived in the area where she had been rounded up, but said he had never seen her on or close to his land. He also liked dogs. Perhaps there was some odor she had detected that had engendered fear and her unwarranted attack, but from then on I was wary of her behavior when I introduced her to any stranger. The immediate result was that she lost the freedom of the house when there were visitors, a sad beginning to our relationship, but the risk was too great to do otherwise. Aburisa seemed at ease in the presence of all women and was friendly to most men, including my elder brother who visited me from the mainland once a month. She liked my neighbors, too, so perhaps she felt more secure in the presence of the elderly, although the person she had attacked without any provocation on his part was not a young man. However, I kept her on a very short leash when we went out, and this, coupled with the knowledge of bears in the vicinity, meant walks became a duty rather than a pleasure. I was able to appreciate her small size as she could fit into my friends' cars and accompany me to their more distant homes. Sam had always been welcome when I visited friends on foot, but despite being loved by all, drivers felt uncomfortable with a dog bigger than themselves occupying a seat close to them. Aburisa was at her best in my garden. Initially, I thought she might dig her way to freedom under the solid, high wooden fence, but from the moment she saw the old plum tree, it became her special domain. I had never owned a dog who could climb trees, and when she first jumped up and walked along the lower branch, I feared she might attempt to escape via the sun deck. I immediately took precautions, lining the nearest side with hardboard, but I do not think she ever considered walking to the end of the nearest branch. She liked climbing, jumping from one branch to another until she reached the place of her choice, where she would stand and view the neighborhood for long periods of time. Occasionally, she would lie down, but I was used to think that she felt safer standing, perhaps alert to imagined perils she might have encountered in the past. That's all the time we have to read on today's broadcast. We have been reading together 90 Years with Dogs by Dorothy M. Norris. Remember, you can hear this and other audio reader programs on the web at reader.ku.edu/digital-archive. My name is Pam Bloom. Thank you for joining me.